Hello and welcome to what is now Season 5 of Pebble in the Pond podcast. My name is Sam Stewart and I am the CEO of the Australian and New Zealand Mental Health Association. Each year, ANZMHA hosts several leading mental health conferences which give us the opportunity to connect with incredible industry leaders, lived experience speakers, researchers, academics and frontline workers as they share fascinating stories and projects which are changing the face of mental health within our community. Listen in as we go one-on-one with these inspiring people and dive deep into their work. It is truly a privilege to bring you their stories. Our podcast episodes may contain content which could be triggering for some people. If you need support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit the Get Help page on anzmh.asn.au. Join us for Pebble in the Pond each Tuesday and let's get into Season 5. Nicole Gibson is an award-winning social entrepreneur, systems architect, author, and philosopher. From supporting communities with emotional infrastructure with the not-for-profit foundation Love Out Loud, to working on meaningful and complex system change within the tech field, Nicole is an absolute powerhouse. In today's episode, we cover a lot of ground, from Nick's personal story with anorexia and how her introspection brought her to a new path and journey to what the future of mental health could mean for individuals. We talk about our natural disposition to want to heal and how a lot of us struggle with that. We touch on how cultural changes over the last century have allowed for less time for self and introspection as our addiction and reliance on technology takes hold. Welcome, Nick. Nick, thanks so much for coming and having a yarn to me. It's good to see you again. And listen, I'm looking forward to our conversation. It's been a while.
Same, Sam. Thank you for having me.
Well, you don't have an accent. I thought, you know, the time that you're spending in LA, you might come back with a bit of an accent. But when we last spoke, it would have been 2018, possibly, at our eating disorders conference. And you were in the midst of starting something, a bit of a movement, a bit of a something pretty new. And it was Love Out Loud.
What a time.
I haven't spoken to you since. So we're talking a good 5 years at least.
Yeah.
Maybe six. Mm-hmm. Tell me, what's been going on with you?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that was such a turning point in my life and my journey. I was finishing my last term as a federal commissioner. And yeah.
That's right.
Stepping away from the nonprofit that I'd led for 7 or 8 years. And that was my first commercial pursuit. If you had told me then that I would find myself in the midst of Silicon Valley, I would have thought you were absolutely out of your mind.
Well, you had big dreams.
Yeah, for sure, but not tech, you know. Yeah. But it's interesting in today's world, you know, if you're interested in meaningful and complex systems change, it was only a matter of time before technology was going to come into the equation. Mm. But yeah, I mean, at that time, the reason I chose to go in that direction and commit myself to writing Love Out Loud, which was, you know, a consolidation of all of my observations working with people in this really raw way as a facilitator leading my first company, which was a nonprofit that did complex community development work and capacity building. I was supporting communities at the time to build what I called emotional infrastructure, which back then, that was a very radical idea, which seems crazy now that, God forbid, you know,
yes,
there's cultural and environmental causations for our challenges as a species. But it was a very important foundation to my work now because it really showed me that, you know, there's more of what makes us the same than what separates us. And my work led me to work with children in the midst of rural communities all the way through to, you know, politicians in high places and everything in between. And I recognize that actually what we struggle with as individuals is far more similar than it is different, although it kind of has different wrapping paper. Mm. And so my attempts to consolidate that inside Love Out Loud, yeah, catalyzed this movement of people, which now expands over 40 countries globally.
It's amazing. In fact, let's give our listeners a bit of context. What made you want to get into the mental health stuff in the first place?
Yeah.
At such a young age.
So my first love was theater. And the reason I fell in love with theater, I now realize, was the invitation to be able to create a space for individuals where everyone became extremely present and present in witness to the rawness of the human experience and vulnerability. And I had this undying love for that experience. And I recognize now that I was a very sensitive, present person in a world that for the most part lacked that presence. And that gave me an outlet. And I pursued that really seriously. I left school to go to a performing arts academy at 14. And the one thing I didn't have was this understanding that we need to love ourselves and have a positive relationship with ourselves in order to really make our dreams sustainable and tangible. And I had, you know, every opportunity that a 14, 15-year-old could dream of who was pursuing their artistic passion, but I didn't have that relationship with myself sorted. And that led to a life-threatening eating disorder, anorexia. And I was just sharing this story actually with someone at the conference, you know, going head-to-head with the realization of death at a very young age, it changes you in ways that are very difficult to describe. And since then, I've had this acute awareness and almost this sense of urgency that this life isn't permanent, and every experience has an impermanence to it, which is ultimately what creates meaning. And it forced me, that experience, to ask very, I suppose, philosophical questions about life, which was, you know, is this construct of identity something I'm really prepared to die for? And thank goodness the answer was no. But then the question became, well, what do I want to live for? And that to me was making a positive impact in the world. And it was an interesting experience going through that, because unlike, I think, a lot of other mental health challenges, when your mental health is something that you're wearing on a physical level, you really get to meet people's relationship to that. And I became aware through that experience that I had the ability to kind of separate myself and personalize what I was experiencing from a lot of people at that time, which was this confrontation and this ultimately this fear of suffering and this fear of vulnerability that people either needed to sort of reject, dismiss, pretend like it wasn't there as a way of coping with how they felt that vulnerability inside themselves. And so experiencing that also made me ask a lot of very big questions, which is if we're rejecting vulnerability at this level, if we don't have a capacity to be present with the depth of vulnerability at this level, what other problems are we not solving as humanity? And I think it was in those questions that I found my passion for what has become a very relentless entrepreneurial pursuit to solve this foundational problem, which to me I define as ultimately fear, the opposite of love, but otherwise put this kind of radical and very normalized level of emotional dysregulation, which prevents us from accessing compassion and a capacity to extend ourselves in a multitude of different ways, from difficult conversations to basic kindness of another person. And, you know, why? I think because a lot of us are carrying pain. A lot of us in one way or another feel unseen and not heard and maybe have a broken heart because we don't have a society that welcomes us, you know, to be all of ourselves and constantly wants to hijack our attention away from the trueness of who we are by nature. And I wanted to solve that problem. But the first 10 years of my journey leading up to now and the development of what we're now building with Intruth Technology was really wanting to define that problem in a way that had a solid enough foundation that the solution could go on to change the world in a paradigm shifting way.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's no small task to try and go and achieve such a thing. Did you think, well, you mentioned a couple of keywords there, vulnerability, presence. Do you think a lack of that in society is where some of our challenges, our mental health challenges, are stemming from? Do you think that separation, the loneliness, although we're connected, we're not as well connected as we think, maybe we don't have that self-love that we need to? Is that where you think it's the root cause is?
Yes.
Yeah,
I really do. And I don't mean to oversimplify it, but there's a few principles that my work has shown me over the years, and that's when you get out of the way. And I think that that's what happens when you're fully present. You're no longer kind of hijacked by the past and the future and distraction. When you can be with what truly is, there's a natural disposition in us to want to heal. And when you look at the reactiveness of our systems, it's no wonder that people struggle to heal, because there's no space to really be present with what is. You know, our innate intelligence is so, so profound, you know, and I think all of us understand in one way or another why we suffer the way that we suffer, which therein lies the answer when we start asking the right questions. But that requires space. And why aren't we present? You know, and presence is like a fitness. You need to have a practice which brings you back to that state, which then allows you to not become triggered when something in you arises, and also when something in life or in someone you care about arises. And I think this is where the challenge kind of is. We can have a lot of awareness, and this has been the landscape of mental health for some time now, is awareness raising. But I think where that needs to now extend to is capacity building. And that starts with internal capacity for us to be comfortable and willing to be present with difficulty. And I mean, that's a big conversation, because we're designed to be resilient. You know, we're designed to be relatively adaptive when it comes to challenges. But we're living in a society where I think at the moment there's a cost to the convenience we find ourselves within that is damaging us in ways that aren't talked about.
Yeah. Do you think it's part of the culture of the way things have always, like in Australia, for instance, do you think that's sort of the way we've treated each other, the expectations? Do you think that's sort of the environment it's created that? Or do you think it's something that we've always have, we just haven't tuned into it or haven't been open to it?
So the culture that drives the lack of ability to be present, Yeah, it's definitely cultural, and it's a learnt behavior. You know, like when I was growing up, I at least had to wait a week before I watched the next Simpsons episode. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something to be said for that it's a delayed gratification.
Yeah.
And when you're constantly marketed an idea, you know, and told that you can have it now, when it doesn't happen now, then there can be a considerable amount of frustration and unrealistic expectation of what certain things in life really take. And think about that in the context of relationships. If you want to have an intimate, meaningful relationship, there has to be a willingness to be in the inevitable discomfort that comes with disagreement, a lack of understanding at times, you know. How do you build a bridge within that? If you have an expectation of life that everything you want to experience should be happening at will, it can create such a discord. And I think then the temptation to move in directions where we can have that dopamine hit, that instant gratification, which now extends across all areas of life, not just social media. You can get food delivered to your door, you can have sex on demand, whatever it is. You know, it's a very toxic way of living.
And it's only getting quicker.
Mm-hmm.
Like the way things are going, we are getting things at our fingertips when we want it now. And do you think that technology has enabled that, or that's our own doing?
Yeah, I think technology is like a magnifying glass. You know, it's not necessarily the technology. It's the way which you know is often said, it's the way we're using technology. The tool itself isn't evil or bad. A hammer can be used to build a house, and it can be used to, you know, hurt someone. The way technology has basically commercialized our attention, so the motivation behind a lot of companies in technology is to get your attention for as long as possible and to keep you on a platform for as long as possible. So there's this constant externalization of one's self-awareness. And that definitely, I think, is posing challenges which we can't completely quantify, because true connection to self, and I think a true sense of wholeness and the ability to be present, is when we have a very solid relationship with self. And that requires time with self and time of introspection And I do think technology is making that, our use of technology is making that more and more difficult because it is an addiction. If you look at the brain and its dopamine receptors in using a platform like TikTok, for example, it's parallel to taking crack cocaine. So it's now chemical. It's not just cultural. And there's got to be an actual detoxification process if you want to win back your consciousness at this point.
What's the downside if we don't?
Yeah, so the downside, I think this is a very important question. The downside is if we lose our ability to, again, extend ourselves because everything has become so easy that, you know, there's a predisposition for apathy or laziness, then what is that going to mean for the visioning of our society? Once upon a time, philosophers would spend decades on a single thought. Now our attention span is about 1.3 seconds. So when you just think about,
wow,
you know, the cost to our society, just thinking about that. And it was also known in those times that debate was encouraged and debate was considered to be a very important and almost sacred part of society because there was a foundational understanding that ideas, only ideas that were morally good, would actually be defensible ultimately. And so think about that in the context of our world today. And this is a somewhat controversial perspective, but if we start to place, I guess, more of a postmodernistic ideal on society, which says, you no longer have the freedom to offend me, there's so many challenges in that. And I think that the real problem that we need to solve for is our level of self-security and our level of resilience to be able to handle differences of opinion rather than trying to shut down or make the world centered around self. And this is actually coming from a place of deep personal lived experience with mental illness. Like ultimately, I actually wrote this in Love Out Loud that my recovery was this shift from a self-oriented view of life, which was about me, my eating disorder, what I could control ultimately, to asking how I could be present with what is in the world and actually extend myself beyond myself. That is what healed me and what improved my quality of life. And I think we're at great risk of losing the ability to do that, which on every level of society has implication.
Yeah, it's almost like a bit of a numbing, isn't it, of society to an extent where we no longer have that ability to have real conversations and engage in real relationships. And you just worry if we go too far down that route, it's a bit of a shame, isn't it, for where things could end up, and quite scary.
Yeah, well, the rawness of humanity needs to have a value beyond our own comfort. And I think there needs to be maybe more voices for that message that more of humanity can relate to. And yeah, tools, you know, what we're developing ultimately is designed to give people an insight into their emotional patterns and triggers so that they can start to take responsibility for themselves and their reactions to life. I think, you know, if you want something in the external world to change, and in a way, Sam, this was always my challenge with the mental health industry. It was so much advocacy of what needed to change on the outside and not necessarily looking in the mirror and asking, well, how can I be a more present person? How can I be more honest? How can I be more noble and honorable and, you know, all of those things? And if we focus too much, you know, on the external, then we lose where meaningful change can really happen, because that is what needs to change, is our response to life and our relationship with life. That's the only thing that can change ultimately in any of our realities.
There's a lot of growth in reflection, isn't there?
Well, that's what all therapies are ultimately designed to try to instigate, is self-reflection. And that really sort of astounded me as I came into my adulthood, how little people self-reflect. I was always a very reflective, introspective child and still am. And yeah, how many very esteemed people who have achieved huge amounts of success and hold considerable positions of power still won't reflect? And why is that? Is it a series of defenses that have been so built and built up in that person that it's become now so difficult to turn the mirror back around potentially, but also it's not encouraged in our society. Self-reflection's not encouraged.
For a long time now, you've been a big advocate for love and the power of love. Do you want to give us or give the listeners a bit of insight into what that means and your experience with what that can achieve and why it's so important?
Yeah, great question. The first thing I want to say to that is we need to bust the myths of love, because love has been reduced in many ways in the eyes of society to a Hollywood cliche. And I think that that's incredibly tragic. Love is first and foremost an action and a skill set. At least that's how I like to teach it, that all of us need in order to improve the quality of our life to commit to, just like any other skill. Love's nature, and this has come from a deep observation of communities who have managed to, that I've worked with, that have managed to cultivate more love and compassion in their general way of being. Love is inclusive. Love is creative. Love is solution oriented. Love is the ability to lean in to challenge versus contract, which is a mechanism of fear. To be open-minded, to not need to be right, and to be present. And all of these qualities paramount to healing. And it starts with ourselves, as cliche as that is. You know, can you truly be present with yourself? Can you be alone? Can you talk kindly to yourself? Can you forgive yourself for the times that you've hurt yourself, betrayed yourself, hurt others, betrayed others? And when we have that internal capacity, the ability to then hold others in compassion, especially those that maybe do things we can't understand or do things that would otherwise hurt us, can we see the innocence in where that actually comes from, which is always pain? You know, it's from that higher ground, that bird's eye view, that we're able to rise above the problems and the challenges that we face in our own lives and as a society, and find a way beyond those challenges. And love is crucial. You know, it's like for anyone that's fallen in love and had that experience in a romantic context, you can go from being the most pessimistic person to all of a sudden feeling like the world is opening up, that anything is possible, that you can achieve things that you never thought imaginable. There's a quality to love which is very miraculous, that when we think about some of the things that we need to move through as a humanity, like just take layers of intergenerational trauma that has been discussed in part throughout this conference, that's going to take a radical willingness to love anyway, to relinquish the need to be right and to choose a higher ground and a different path. And ultimately, until we choose that, we will be stuck in these paradigms of fear to some degree.
And fear, obviously, in this is the opposite of love. Mm-hmm. So if we're looking at that, how is the fear is something that we're bringing upon ourselves, do you think, too often? But then fear is also extrinsic as well, is it, from the environment that you're in possibly? Or do you think, like, where is a fear coming from?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to say to that is fear is it's an evolutionary setting, and it's not a bad thing. The very reason we experience fear from an evolutionary standpoint is so that I can ultimately experience myself as separate to you, so that if I ever was in the coalface of threat, I had an ability to act in a self-preserving way and survive. And it also gives us this amazing experience to be an individual. And so let's kind of appreciate fear for what it's giving us, which is ultimately this individual experience. And so that means fear is triggered when we move into a state that's unknown. And that's because in a state of unknown, we're confronted with the reality that we can't control our environment, and we don't know what, you know, what could be there in terms of threat. And when you look at our society, we're often and on a very regular basis put into that state because of triggers in our society that are constantly putting us into a reactive mode, where we feel like there's so much stimulus we can't control, we can't control its impact on us anymore. And it's not a natural way for us to exist. We're not designed to handle this level of input. And that doesn't mean we can't, but I think taking a moment to appreciate that the exponential growth in this over the past several decades, compared to the thousands of years where the only time that we would have had that fear-based response was maybe once every couple of days when there was some kind of, you know, animal that was going to be chasing us in a tribal setting, and that would last for a whole of a couple of minutes and you'd be filled with adrenaline and either fight the threat or run away from the threat, and then you'd move back into a state of ease and presence. We don't really get that space unless we intentionally make it for ourselves. And so it puts us into this fight or flight state all the time. And I think that definitely contributes to the breaking down of ability to be in a loving present state.
We want to move towards a civilization of love. What does that look like?
Well, let's define civilization. I think a civilization's built up of systems. And in Love Out Loud, we talk about this a lot in my company. So we focus on health as a system, education as a system, economics as a system, technologies as systems, and what are the foundations that those systems have been built upon, and what does love look like in terms of a foundation for those systems. I think a very big part of that conversation is power. I think there's two types of power. There's power and control, and there's power and love. Power and control, by design, has to be taken from the world beyond us in order to feel powerful. I think a lot of our systems right now are built on that. The handing over of one's power to a bigger authority or institution. Whereas power and love is reciprocal, that it first comes from within, it's intrinsic, and it can be given boundlessly and will return tenfold, you know, and this is what's possible for us as a civilization, as a species. But again, it's a level of consciousness that can't be, there's no shortcut. We have to get there genuinely. And I see this play out all the time in conversations around decentralization and blockchain and the development of DAOs. And I think to myself, well, if the level of consciousness that humans go into those agreements and those systems with is the same as the same thinking and the same level of consciousness that's built our current systems, we'll find the same roadblocks in one way or another. I think, yeah, again, it has to start, it has to come from self, so that when we design and co-design new systems, it's genuinely on a foundation of equalness and collaboration, and the egos at the door and the greeds at the door, a genuine willingness to hear each other, see each other, and to understand that, which is the truth, that in order for me to win, you have to win, that it's not combative by design. Life's working as an ecosystem. At least that's what I believe. I think when we get that straight, then we really can build a civilization of love.
As it relates to technology and the role that technology plays in enabling or to help assist this moving forward, what do you think the role of technology or AI or Meta, whatever, all these things that are happening at the moment in this space, what do you think the role of that is to enable such a destination?
There's a lot of ways to answer that question. I can speak to what I see in what Love Out Loud's developing.
Yep.
Artificial intelligence obviously has a profound capacity to look at patterns and recognize patterns and predict based on those patterns. And when you correlate that to oneself, that is ultimately what awakening is. You know, it's the ability to see ourselves and understand why we're doing what we're doing. And in the advancement of AI, if it's used to support us to understand ourselves in a more intimate way, with what we're developing, it's technology that ultimately measures emotional state, and it's really accessible to the user, to the individual. So it's useful to know what that is in real time. But the thing that's even more fascinating to me in what we're developing is what that looks like over time. So the nuances and the complexities of your emotional patterns, how that's affecting decision-making that you're doing. With that information, even for an avid meditator, it is very difficult to distinguish the nuances of your emotional patterns. What that will liberate an individual to do, if used in the right way, unlocks a decision-making power that is unprecedented. So the quality of our decisions, the intentionality of our decisions can become so powerful. And you would know this from leading an organization. The quality of an organization and its growth and its people often lies on the shoulders of the leader's ability to make effective decisions. So that, to me, is a very exciting part of this conversation. On the other hand, if it's used to take us away from ourselves, you know, and is used, those patterns are used to coerce and manipulate towards consumerism, that's very destructive.
Mm. You hope it's going to be the first case. I mean, you want it to try and support us in our roles and trying to be the best version of ourselves and to accentuate the life that we want to live rather than destruct and pull it apart. And we hope that that's the way it's going to go. We're seeing some really fast innovations with this. Really, technology seems to be constantly changing, and the use of it seems to be keep adapting and evolving as we go. Day by day, there seems to be new applications of it and how it can help. As you look at the mental health sector, where do you think it's heading, and how do you think it'll support the end user, the clients, the people that need support?
Yeah, what I see in the mental health sector is maybe what it is different to what I see in terms of mental health as a problem that we face. I don't really have a lot of faith that mental health as a sector, as an industry, especially under government regulation and bureaucracy, will be able to keep up with the growing amount of commercial solutions that exist and continue to be created in this space. I could be biased.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think because it is such a problem and governments are showing that they're struggling to keep up with the level of innovation that's happening and the level of growth that's happening in the space, I think this will more and more shift to the for-profit commercial sector to basically produce products and solutions. So, I mean, I like to see the exciting possibility in that, which is potentially we could be on the precipice if the right entrepreneurs and the right leaders and the right minds drive that change and that shifting, we could be on the precipice of really having a lot more sovereignty in our ability to manage our health. And a lot more awareness on a daily sort of individual level to understand ourselves. The amount of data that even just your iPhone tracks, even if you don't have any, you know, biometric or wearable devices, is quite interesting. I would encourage anyone just to go into Apple Health and look at how much data is actually there about you. It's quite profound. And what that can teach you and how much that can actually support you to improve your health when you know how to, when you become literate in how to read that data and what to do with that data. So that's only going to become more personalized. That's only going to become more sophisticated. And I get excited about the possibility of a world where every individual is their own healer. Every individual is empowered to understand their system, their body, their mind well enough that they can, to a large degree, work towards resolving any suffering that's in their life and dis-ease that's in their life. I don't think we should aim to ever fully replace a specialist's or human's role in that. But definitely from my time working in mental health, I think there was too much onus on experts having answers to the point that many people who were trying to resolve their mental health just didn't have the power that they needed as an individual to really choose health for themselves.
Mm. Give us a bit of an update on the US. I mean, you're spending a fair bit of time over there now. Is it about half your time or you're over there full time?
It's technically home.
Yeah. So what's it been like being immersed in that culture over there? And secondly, where's this all happening? How's the mental health sector happening over there? How's it all going over there?
I mean, the mental health sector, just like the health sector in general in the States, is a bit of a challenging situation. But yeah, I mean, health tech is an absolutely booming industry, biotech, health tech, that governments don't know how to regulate, especially as AI plays more and more of a role in that. And again, a controversial thing to say, I look at companies like Apple and I question, was it actually always in the vision of Steve Jobs to spearhead, you know, Apple as a health data company? Because you look at the level of thinking that's gone into Apple and what it's able to produce, it's possible, you know, maybe we'll never know. But yeah, I see that health data is one of the most important and chased after spaces. Like it's an arms race for companies to build products and solutions that capture the most intricate data of their users. So I think we have to be very careful which companies we support. We have to become literate of what it means to give our data to companies. And, you know, giving your data to a company isn't necessarily a bad thing, but what's going to happen with that data? So, yeah, I mean, Silicon Valley is kind of it's the petri dish of all of the most futuristic conversations about this. It's crazy. Some of the things that you see that are getting developed, you know, I don't think government rebate schemes are anywhere close to keeping up with some of the innovations that are gonna, I think, really make mainstream mental health treatment seem like a thing of the past.
Is that right? Is it pretty nice? Is it pretty inspiring to be over in that environment to see what's possible, how fast things are going, to be around some really probably amazing thinkers and quite advanced companies, to be over in that space?
Yeah, for sure. A conversation that I find myself a part of more and more in the States is the longevity conversation. And people that are very deep in that world, obviously looking at technologies that support lifespan and longevity. And I think that there's a lot of people that aren't quite aware what's going to be possible for us probably in our lifetime, that this idea that we'll die somewhere between 80 and 100 years old, you know, probably isn't true for you and I. And that begs a lot of questions around what we've been taught is a kind of the right way to live our life. Like if we're going to live to 120, 150, 200 years old, or, you know, maybe we don't have to die at all if our consciousness can be salvaged through technology, or our bodies can be healed through nanotechnology.
Wow.
You know, then is it really so important that we get married by 30 and retire by 60, you know? It's because this has all been under the guise that we're going to die at a certain age. And I think that's becoming less and less relevant. And so that's very inspiring because it supports me to rethink. I was already a bit of a maverick in this way, but even more so, rethink what life's really about.
Would you want to live forever?
I believe in the eternity of the spirit, so no.
In the human existence?
No. Meaning to me is captured because of the finiteness.
Yeah, I think it brings meaning, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's a big question, you know, because I think if we truly awaken to what we are, and with that comes this potential to really unlock heaven, and we can find a way to exist that is transcendent of suffering. Maybe that is what, you know, scriptures and prophecies point to as eternal life. Who knows?
It's very exciting, isn't it? Just thinking of it, like it just makes you, just expands your thought process and the boundaries that you think are there just by thinking about questions like that.
100%. Yeah. And it's, you know, already with products like Neuralink, like what have been previously considered to be kind of supernatural abilities, like telepathy or telekinesis, like the fact that you can control something with your mind is technically, it's a telekinetic ability. We're only scratching the surface of what we're capable of. And I really do think that tech in these ways is just a external manifestation of what was always possible within us. So whether or not tech's the bridge or meditating in a cave for 10 years is the bridge, I think it's very exciting to unlock the fullness of human potential, which, you know, even our parents and our grandparents, their preoccupation was survival, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a very, very different time for humanity, especially most jobs will be redundant in a decade or two. So then those that have married their identity to what they do also will have so much more space and freedom to think about what else it is and who else they can be.
Nick, do you want to give our listeners, give them, just spend a few moments by letting everybody know what you're doing now and where you're doing what you're doing, because I think it'd be cool for them to find out what you're up to.
Yeah, so Love Out Loud, as mentioned, grew into a global movement and also an education and training company, and still is today. But then as this question of how can we really get more scale and impact behind what we're doing, and what would that mean if we were to try to develop technology that facilitated that same change that all of our content and our education programs and training programs seek to do? What if we could put that into a technology that has a sort of infinite scale? That's what myself and my incredible team have been working on for the past couple of years. And like I started sharing at the beginning of this interview, I really see that the crux of the core problem here being the lack of emotional capacity, which then means we struggle to be present. And if we could just solve that problem, so many other problems could be solved. That's ultimately what the technology is doing. So when you look at emotional state, we're developing technology that can track emotional state in real time. The way that's been measured historically has been through what's called a valence and arousal model. So the two data points being valence, which is if you're positively or negatively geared towards an idea. If I put a piece of chocolate in front of you and you liked that piece of chocolate, there'd be biosignals which show that you're motivated to move towards it. And if you didn't like it, the opposite. And your state of arousal. So lowest arousal being you're asleep, highest arousal is highly stimulated. Mm. When you combine those two data points, you get an indication of emotional state. So if you have a high valence, high arousal, you're likely to be excited. If you have a low valence but high arousal, you're likely to be angry, etc. This has been measured mostly through EEG, so head complex, 30 nodes on your brain kind of thing that are measuring your brain state. So how can we make that accessible? And I've always been very fascinated with HRV, obviously, because it's the intelligence of the heart. HRV is known to have a very strong ability to measure arousal state, which is why it's used as a fitness tool and used to measure sleep hygiene, things like this, and not so much valence. But the question became, what if we could use machine learning and use the baseline of the EEG data to basically train HRV to be able to improve its ability to understand valence, which is what we're successfully doing. So there's a lot of consumer wearables that have HRV inbuilt. So all of a sudden it becomes something that you would need to go to a neuroscientist that does a brain scan to get this kind of indication. Mm-hmm. Becomes something that you can access just in your day-to-day life. And then because we can track that emotional data, the next question became, how can we make that emotional data mean something to the user, and how can we support the interpretation of that data in a way that's very useful? So I think one of our biggest strengths, and probably one of my biggest strengths as a non-technical founder of a tech company, is my preoccupation and my fascination has been human behavior and psychology. So my ability to think about the product from a user's point of view is very, very strong, whereas I think technical founders are at risk of getting so into the tech that they don't think about the use case. So we're looking at algorithms that take that emotional data and help quantify and correlate your emotional patterns in relation to things like decision making, that are helping you understand how much your emotions fluctuate, how long it takes you to return to a centered state. All of this is giving you very deep insight into you and helping you harness a sense of self-regulation and self-control and ultimately self-empowerment. When you extend that and think about how that could be utilized in a team dynamic, it gets very interesting and exciting. So imagine being able to pull different team members into one data pool and actually be able to see, quote unquote, the collective consciousness of that group. So you can actually see if a team is harmonized or not harmonized and how that could actually support you to create alignment in teams, in regions, in countries. One thing that's really out there, but I think where a technology like this could ultimately lead, is imagine something like a nuclear war was announced, but we had 200 million users on our platform and we had the ability to send a push notification to those users and say, would you like to calibrate to the emotional state of peace, and actually create a unified, embodied field of peace in our world, would that then have a subsequent effect on the ability for something like a nuclear war to even manifest in the first place, which in some ways has already been validated through things like mass collective meditations. And there's been studies that have shown 1 million people meditating and a reduction of crime rate, violence,
really?
Hospital emissions. Yeah. So that's, you know, the quantum field.
Wow.
So if we have technologies that tap into emotional state and allow a recalibration of your emotional body, therefore your vibration, and we can organize that in a collective way, I think it starts to unlock very exciting potentials.
It's really interesting, isn't it? No wonder
so.
You're fascinated. Yeah. and you, I mean, it's amazing. So, I mean, you're in 40 countries now?
Love Out Loud.
Yeah. That's amazing. It's, I mean, where do you want to get to? What's your goal?
We haven't launched the tech to market yet.
Okay.
So our reach has been through our campaigns and our programs and content. But this just feels like the start of a very exciting new chapter. I think the world needs tech companies that are more interested in bringing people back to themselves than they are hijacking people's attention away from themselves. And I do believe that when products like that exist, consumers will choose it over what's currently available. The name of our tech is In Truth. So it's really about coming back to you and your truth and understanding yourself. And I feel like this can act as an alternative to this, I guess, other viewpoint, which is more transhumanism. So, you know, the ideology that in order to sustain our relevance as a species, we have to merge completely with AI. I believe if we can use technology to awaken ourselves, then we can also maintain our sovereignty, which is a deeply important thing to me.
There's integrity there too, which is important.
Yeah.
Nick, as we round it up, people like what they hear, and I think it's an opportunity for everybody to go and check it out. How do they find out more about this?
You can go to loveoutloud.io. You can find me on socials. You can find Love Out Loud on socials.
Oh, good on you.
The tech?
Yeah, that is the tech. They're all the techie ones. I get that.
Yeah.
End of the website. Good on you.
And and the name of the technology is In Truth. So depending on when you're listening to this, you might be able to find In Truth Tech on the App Store.
Cool. Is there a launch date?
No, not a date, but okay. Sometime in September.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, this has been epic. Like just hearing, you know, the space that you're in at the moment and where you've, I mean, 6 years or so since I've seen you, which I always knew, you're a go-getter and you go out there and achieve things and you have a lot of energy, and it's so great to see what you're up to now and hear about everything that you're doing. And I think there's still massive growth and potential in what you're up to, and I'm sure we've only just started scratching the surface with what you're going to get up to, Nick. But we really appreciate you spending some time with me and sharing your story and your journey with our listeners. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Sam.
All right.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share with your friends and colleagues. And if you know someone working in mental health that you'd like to see featured on the podcast, please email any suggestions to us at membership@anzmh.asn.au. You can also stay up to date on our socials at ANZMHA on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you next week.